वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्चा कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च अतीतानं पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालदितिनिराजितपदपङ्कजन्त आजिमुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संश्रयामि। खेलोदुनितखेदयाभिषदया ब्रह्मेलदमोदया सम्यक्षस्रविवादया रसदया चितार्पितोन्मादया शाश्वतभक्तिविनोदया श्रमदया मधुरमर्यादया श्रीचैतन्यनिधे दयाथवादया भूयादमण्डोदया जनुलम्बिता भुजोकनकावदतु सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलायतक्षु विश्वम्बरो द्यावरो जुगधर्मपालु वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारु। नीलम्बोदितते सदाश्रविरह क्षेपन्वितन् बन्धवं श्रीमद्भागवती कथामधिरया सञ्जीवयं भातियं श्रीमद्भागवतं सदाशनयना आश्रुपायनै पूजयं गोस्वामी प्रवरो गदाधर विभोर् भूयाद्मदेकात् गति रासा घनमुहान मूर्ति विचित्र किलिमहोत्सवोल्लासितं राधाचरण विलोदितं रुचिरश्रिखण्डं हरिं वन्दे वृन्दावनेश्वरितवैवपदारविन्दं प्रेमामृतैकमकरन्दरशोघपूर्णं हरिद्यार्पितमधुपते स्मरतापमोग्रं निर्वापयत्परमशीतलमाश्रयामि। भक्त्यविहीनायपराधलक्षये चित्तशाखमादितरङ्गमाध्ये कृपामयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दम्। स्वस्त्यस्तु विश्वासखलो प्रसीदतं जयन्तु भूतानि शिवोन्मितोदय मनश्च भद्रं भजता ददुक्षये अवश्यतं नोमतिरपि हैतुकी। श्री गौड़ वैष्णव गुरु परंपरा की जय। श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय। श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय। श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद गौर गदाधर जी की जय। श्री राधा मदन मोहन राधा गोविंद देव राधा गोपीनाथ जी की जय। अविर्भाव महोत्सव तिथि श्रील भक्ति रक्षक देव गोस्वामी महाराज की जय। अविर्भाव महोत्सव तिथि श्री वीर चंद्र प्रभु की जय। गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो दंडवत प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू एंड समवन टोल्ड मी टुडे मे यू बी ब्लेस्ड इन ब्यूटिफुल कृष्ण कॉन्शियसनेस। आई फेल ओके आई वांट टू एक्सटेंड दैट इंटरेस्टिंग ब्लेसिंग टू ऑल ऑफ यू एज वेल। May you all be blessed in beautiful Krishna consciousness, which is another way of saying Krishna consciousness, but just in case, beautiful Krishna consciousness reminds us what Krishna consciousness is about. So here in Mayapur, as you know, today, at least yesterday, according to my calendar, yesterday was the celebration of the appearance of Srila Siddhar Maharaj, but his followers have been celebrating that today. So I had the fortune of visiting his birthplace in Haponia. I've been going there with Bhaktinandan Swami and another group of devotees as well. First, we went to Sri Chaitanya Saraswat Mat and participated in the morning celebrations there at the feet of Srila Siddhar Maharaj's Samadhi Mandir, Bhajan Kutir, Ishtadev, and whatnot. And then we took a car, 25-kilometer drive to Haponia, which is the small village where Srila Siddhar Maharaj himself was born. And in that same house where he was born, now there is a temple, basically, you know, celebrating, commemorating his divine presence, his divine figure, his divine appearance. So I've just returned an hour or so ago. So it has been a long day, lots of travel from where I am till there, but very happy to be back and somehow share the news that everything has been very auspicious, and Srila Siddhar Maharaj's presence is as fresh, as blessed as ever. So we are all very fortunate, because even some of you, I know that some of you at least may not be that familiar with Srila Bhakti Rakakshardev Goswami Maharaj. Some of you may come in more from an ISKCON background and not being so familiar necessarily with Srila Siddhar Maharaj. But you must know that he's, and you already know at this point, how instrumental and how influential he is in all that we are trying to share here, in all that inspires us in terms of radical personalism and many other details of quote unquote my presentation, which actually is so infused by the influence of different guardians, Srila Siddhar Maharaj being probably one of the most prominent ones, not to say the most prominent. So whether you know it or not in detail, of course, it's very important for me to make that acknowledgement very public and very clear. And of course, with that opening the door for each of you to dive deep into the ocean of his life and teachings, of course. So yeah, very blessed day to gather today. For our Istogosti, we'll be changing somehow the name from Istogosti to Satsang in our flyer and announcement. Maybe you already saw that, but it's another way of talking the same thing. But I felt compelled to call it Satsang in the sense that it's a more usual word. And also it goes straight to the point of Satsanga, no? Sat means real honesty, as we talk many times. Satsanga has to do with getting together, but also with attachment. So satsanga having to do with getting together to get attached to the truth, no? To get attached to living life from a place of honesty. So that's why we are here today, basically, and to see how we can help each other, increasing our commitment to the truth, increasing our attachment to the call to be the most authentic version of ourselves, and how we can do that in a healthy, happy, celebratory way, sustainable, not neurotic, but at the same time, dynamic, progressive, and normal, not normalizing authenticity, so to say. And there's no limit to how much that can happen. So satsang kijai. So that's it. After this not so brief introduction today, I see a few hands raised. I saw more hands raised, a few went down. So I don't know if I already replied to some of your questions by merely invoking Mangalacharan. Everything can happen. So I'm open to that possibility. That's the most important part of the Harikatas. I use, as I like to say, Mangalacharan, the moment of sacred invocation, to be instrumental in the hands of our guardian. So everything can happen in those small seconds, those brief seconds. So, but we have three hands raised now. So we will begin there and let's see where we end today. So Yugal Kishore Prabhu first, you can unmute yourself and we welcome your quest, and let's see in which exploration is throwing us.
Hare Krishna, Swami. Hare Krishna, everybody. Nice to see all of your familiar faces and some new faces. I want to ask my question in honor of Sridhar Swami. And I came across a quote, more of a passage, really. I won't read all of it. Online yesterday from one of his disciples, who's a friend of mine. So if I may share a little, and it leads to a question. I think the question is very pertinent, especially within our men's group. We've been talking a lot about coming out of a Kanishta stage and into a Madhyam Adhikara stage. And mostly the way I've been hearing that framed is like leaving this black and white either or thinking and entering into some nuanced shades of gray that truth can be found essentially everywhere, if you have the eyes to see. So let me share a little bit of the quote and then ask the question. Sridhar Swami says that Madhyam Adhikara is a dangerous zone. That it is in some way characterized by intellectualism, and that this intellectualism can get in the way of faith. Later on, he says, Kanishta Adhikara, if he comes into contact with an Uttama Adhikar, he can clearly pass over Madhyam stage. So Madhyam stage is very dangerous. However, it is necessary to consolidate our faith. And then he gives a quote from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, which I could copy and paste into the chat. But I just wanted to ask you to maybe clarify this point of, are not all three stages, in a sense, unavoidable? That eventually, if we are to reach our goal, we must necessarily pass through all three stages. And in which case is Madhyam so dangerous? And in which case is it actually possible to jump over and skip that stage?
What's the quote you are referring to from Chaitanya Charitamrita?
Let me paste it into the chat right now.
Yeah, just to have as much as the context as we can. Oh, Siddhanta Valiya Chittanakara Lashya Haita Krishna Laga Sudrida Manas. Okay, that's a verse, famous verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Krishna Das Kailash Goswami says, you should Siddhanta Valiya Chitta, try to entertain in your mind Siddhanta, try to discern Siddhanta Nakara Alas, means do not be lazy. So that's interesting. And by doing so, Iha Haita Krishna Laga Sudrida Manas. Krishna will become more firmly established in your own mind, in your inner world, by engaging your discernment capacities in connection to Siddhanta, to the revelation of the scripture, let's put it that way. So yeah, I get your question. It sounds contradictory at times, like, okay, Madhyam is dangerous, so it seems that you can skip that stage, but at the same time, he's emphasizing, actually, you cannot, you should not, you have to engage your quality, your intellect, your head in some way or another. So what to do with that? So first of all, one technical mention, Jugal Kishore, because you are referring to Srila Siddhar Maharaja Sridhar Swami. And I will clarify, generally, we don't refer to him as Sridhar Swami, since there is another Sridhar Swami, which is the famous ancient commentator of the Bhagavatam that Mahaprabhu revered a lot. So just for the sake of making it clear who we are talking about, generally we refer to him whether Srila Siddhar Maharaj, Srila Bhakti Rakshak, Siddhartha Goswami, etc. But generally the Sridhar Swami title, two-word title, is more directed to this ancient commentator of the Bhagavatam. Just a technical detail. So going to your your question, I would say that what Srila Siddhar Maharaj is pointing here is not so much that being a Madhyam Adhikari is so dangerous, but just that there is a danger in that stage as there is dangers in other stages. No? I mean, there are other sections where he will talk about the dangers of being a Kanishta Adhikari. No? Of course, he's not recommending here, oh, if you're a Madhyam, that's too dangerous. Better go back to Kanishta. That's safer. No, he's not saying that. No, he's just saying, actually, Madhyam is a more desirable situation than Kanishta, but it doesn't mean that there are no dangers there. No, so according, every particular stage of the journey has its own potential pitfalls. Let's put it that way. And you can even make the case that the more advanced you are, the more painful will be the falling down if it happens. Because you are going higher and higher and higher, so you fall from there, that's painful for sure. No? So that's a point to make. And from that place, we could make a case of why he's making this prevention strong. No? Saying like, okay, Madhyam Adhikari is a lot about integrated head and heart. Let's put it that way. No? That's part of this nuanced mentality that Emmadiyam is characterized by, not seeing things in grays, not in black and white, being concerned with nuance, being concerned with the in-betweens, so to say, and how, as you say, truth can manifest. There's no literalism, but there is a more interpretative way of reading things, reality, scripture, everything. So big part of the exercise of the Madhyam is an integration of head and heart. So the potential danger there is that instead of integrating head and heart, we become too much stuck in the head, so to say. No, that's basically what he's speaking here about, the danger of intellectualism. We become too much trapped in trying to think, to figure out Krishna consciousness exclusively from the head or prominently from the head, and lose sight of how the head should be in service of the heart so far, no? So that's, I think, what he's mentioning, but he's not discouraging being a Madhyam. He's mentioning, okay, if you're a Kanishta and you meet an Uttam, you somehow skip this danger. So what's the meaning of that, of course? I wouldn't say that means that you just avoid the whole stage of Madhyam altogether, but I will say that you will receive in contact with an Uttam Bhagavat enough deep impact of realization of proper integration that will impact you to the point of being very clear that the highest stage of realization has nothing to do with getting stuck in the head. Now, if you're a Kanista, you are not so much in the head, so to say. It's more in, let's say, on some level, there is sentimentalism playing out through Rupa Goswami will use expression Lokika Shraddha. So, I have my hands raised. I don't know why, sorry. Lokika Shraddha, which means some kind of sentimental faith. And then he goes to Shastriya Shraddha, which is scriptural faith. So your faith is based on revelation, but in the beginning, your faith is mostly based on sentiment, which is not so much based on revelation. So a Kanishta is characterized by the latter. But if he or she meets an Uttam Bhagavat, that Kanishta will receive feeling, I'm feeling above the head, but feeling fully realized. No, it's in one way, externally, it may seem similar, a Kanishta and an Uttam, so to say. But there's a big difference between the two. So I will say, Srila Sarmarja is saying that if you're a Kanishta and you meet an Uttam, and he's speaking in general, of course, each case is unique. But in general, you could say, okay, the contact with an Uttam can bring certain bhakti samskaras, certain very powerful devotional expressions, in which that Kanishta, it's not that we'll skip Madhyam altogether, but has received enough impact from an Uttam to know that the whole journey is not a heady one. So even if that Kanishta will have to go through some integration and discernment, head and heart, has already received this clear experience, direct experience of Uttam Bhakti, what it means to be there. And it's very clear that it has nothing to do with getting stuck in intellectualism. So that will be a very powerful reminder and will protect that Kanishta when he or she's going through the Madhyam chapter of the journey, which again, most have to. But having had that particular previous experience, so intellectualism won't be that much of a danger for that person. And so I will say that all overall, knowing the type of emphasis that Srila Siddhar Maharaj will make in his presentation, many times he's preventing intellectualism. Although he's a giant intellectual, he's a great scholar, he loves to think a lot. And at the same time, that's what I find so charming about him. He's such a thinking person, but he's so expert in putting a stop to your thinking also. Now, he knows so well when to cancel the intellect and inspire you to something beyond that, to surrender, let's put it that way. Now, to make this point, there's a point where you cannot think Krishna, as we were talking yesterday. even quoting Saint Augustine, I think he will say, if you can think about it, it's not God. No, if you can think it, it's not God. God is not thinkable. No, what does it mean to think God, right? No. So again, we have to use our faculties till the point of collapse, so to say, till the point that they say, I'm exhausted. And then you have to resort to another method, basically. So Srila Tsimaraj is very much keen on this. No? He invites us to think. He brings new perspectives. He's always changing your angle of vision, as he's famous for. So he's creating these holy shifts, as I like to say it. But also, he's also very expert in knowing where to put a stop to that, no? And emphasizing the achintya nature of the divine. Again, we don't want to press that button quickly, but we shouldn't discard the button altogether from the keyboard, so to say. No, because if not, we fall prisoners of intellectualism, no? So there is a point that you will gain, we will gain more knowledge by what Brahma said, no? Jnana prayasam udapasya namanta eva. Famous prayers, Brahma Stuti. Now, Brahma is the greatest thinker of the universe, four heads, thinking four directions. He's the greatest scientist of the cosmos, if you want to put it that way. He has a big thinking capacity. But when he's confronted with aprakrit, with the plane, with the supramundane reality of Vrindavan in this case, Brahma is saying, Jnana prayasam udapasya. No? Prayasa, no? Rupa Goswami speaks about prayasa, no? Right? In Upadeshamrita, second verse, he's speaking about prayasa, like making unnecessary efforts. So he's saying, Jnana prayasam, the unnecessary effort of thinking, udapasya, has to be utterly rejected. Excessive intellectualism is condemned. And instead, Gyan prayasa udapasya namanta eva. Namanta eva. He says, offer namaskar, offer pranam. Use your head to bow down and know by this, by that. No? You can use your head to try to understand everything, and it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. And when the head is saying, please, is begging for mercy and saying, stop right now, namanta eva. No, now you can do. You can still do something with your head, which is put it on the ground and surrender, saranagati, pranam, acknowledging the ever-evolving mystery full of wonder that Krishna is, because intellectualism kills wonder, basically, right? It's kind of a self-sabotage enterprise. Now, we want to live in wonder, as we were talking the other day, because without wonder, how much there is purpose and meaning to life. Now, imagine a life devoid, utterly devoid of wonder is basically the same as saying it's a purposeless and meaningless life. And so intellectualism is something like that. It's something that tries to capture all the charm, to squeeze all purpose and meaning, control, calculate, process, figure out. But the end result of that is there is no more wonder available, at least to our perception. So we don't want that. That's the end of everything. So yeah, I will say that's the main spirit of Srila Siddhar Maharaj behind all this, trying to put everything in its place. Yes, we have to think, but thinking has its own dangers. We have to know when to put a pause to that process. But let's not be lazy, as he quotes Chaitanya Charitamrita. Let's study, let's know the scriptures, let's be familiar with revelation, but let's then think about that things we are studying. It's not just learning the verses, learning the dogma, learning the belief, learning the formula, but understanding revelation is an ongoing affair. It's an ever, revelation continues to reveal itself, right? Revelation is not a museum piece, a relic of the past, a static conclusion that nothing else can be said about that. So revelation is an ongoing affair, no? So all the things put together, no? And being a Madhyam entails a lot doing engaging in this exercise constantly, no? Learning to keep everything in its place without the temptation of needing to cancel something so something else remains in place. No, everything can remain in its own place. Even the dangers of everything can remain in its own place, and I can have a big, broad picture of what is what and proceed accordingly. So I don't know if that helps you well, Kishore.
It
yes.
helps. It helps a lot. Yes. It does make me, of course, think of something further, but maybe if time permits, I can just add
time one. Time permits. Go on right now.
So in Uttama, you have said, I believe, and please correct me if I'm misquoting or misremembering, that an Uttama will appear to us in this world generally as a Madhyam. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that for an Uttam to be someone relatable to us, he or she will force him herself to a Madhyam platform, because if not, it's not too relatable for us, because an Uttam is like absolutely lost in the vision of God being everywhere and everything in God, and it's difficult even to speak about it. It's difficult to even understand what's that.
Sure. So maybe in that sense, it's not that the intellect is abandoned in the highest stage, but
no.
that the intellect maybe comes into more view for the, for preaching, let's just say, for preaching to a Kanishta or to someone who's not yet on the stage. So then the Kanishta is seeing, oh yes, this person, they're appearing as someone who's using this discerning intellect, but they're actually beyond, in some way beyond it.
Yeah, I will say that in the case of an Uttam, and again, as much as I can say, not being an Uttam myself at all, but of course there is an intellect there, but an Uttam Bhagavat is so much, there is such a predominance of, let's put it this way, the activated potential of the soul in an Uttam stage. The intellect is being used by the Uttam, but not so much in a, how to say, with the same level of awareness and effort we may employ in our stages. Not that we need to consciously discern in a certain way, in a certain direction. For an Uttam, that person is enlightened, and that person is having this like non-stop plug-in to the divine. So in one sense, there is something beyond the intellect that is, there is a current and a way beyond the intellect, because we have all these layers, right? Like air, water, fire, ether, mind, intellect, ego, atma, and then the fully activated atman. So an Uttam is someone living in the highest potential of the soul. So all the below, quote unquote, inferior layers are naturally pervaded by the reality of that enlightened soul, so to say. No, so intellect is there. I'm not saying it's not there. I'm not saying even when we say, but when, even when we say an Uttam goes down to the Madhyam stage, I mean, it's a way of saying, because it's not that it goes down. It's still an Uttam. The Uttam is an Uttam. It's just, it's a compassionate extension to make whatever that person is experiencing, to make it more relatable for us who are not in Uttam stage. But I will say that the intellect is how to say, is accompanying, so to say, whatever comes as a very powerful current descending through that person. Still, it's there. Still, the Uttam uses it. But I will say it's an awakened intellect. So naturally, intuitively, it discerns and it thinks and it expresses itself in a very different way than the way we used to think about thinking. We used to think about discerning. We used to think, and what's the intellect? What's the function of the intellect? And generally, we relate to how it works for us. But again, in the case of an Uttam Bhagavat, there is intellect. But again, they have a very deep intuition on how to serve, how to love Krishna. So everything comes from a very, very spontaneous place, no? Yeah.
The intellect is not in, is not the driver.
Exactly. Every function is driven by divine love, basically. Even when we speak about the uttam being down to a madhyam, of course, that implies some level of more presence and awareness in how to interact with others. On some level, I'm not denying that, but on some level, that person is still driven by the highest force, so to say. So all the functions, all the layers, all the departments are activated by that, no? So it's a very different background and motivation, so to say. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Swamiji.
Okay, we'll go with the, there are a few more raised hands. Sweta Dibradhika and Amanda Vikram, please, your turn.
Pranam Maharaj, my question's related to this common practices or standard practices in Krishna consciousness. Just a little bit of background. Just other day, we were watching like a little clip of some program in the temple, and they wanted to, like, you know, there's this like common practice of appreciating the guest. Like they're saying, oh, let's appreciate the guest by chanting loudly, chanting the Maha Mantra loudly 3 times, you know? So like, I was thinking, oh, this is like, you know, it's a common practice I have seen, but it, for whatever reason, it made me feel a bit of distasteful, you know, like, not because I think it is wrong, but like I kind of saw myself having done that in the past, like in a ritualistic way, without really like, you know, like it wasn't really meaningful and like, oh, you know, I want to appreciate like that. So it's just one example, but I see like many other practices like that. I kind of feel like I need to move away from that and do it differently or something that's more meaningful. So it's just wondering that, is that like the natural course of progression, as in like, is that the direction we go? So our sadhana like becomes more like custom and unique to relate to Krishna, or is that like, is it just a phase and we go back to all these practices and with an intention to preserve what's come down in the lineage or like, you know, given by acharyas?
Okay, thank you for the question. I personally never heard of that practice of saying Hare Krishna 3 times and appreciating a guest. I'm not against that. I'm just never heard about it. And so, because I surprised because you were speaking about, okay, some of the most usual practices in our tradition, you mentioned something that I never heard about. So I felt like I'm completely out of Krishna consciousness here, because I mean, this is the most, one of the main practices, and I've never heard about it. What have been doing the last 25 years of my life?
Well, I think I should have said in ISKCON.
Okay, thanks for the clarification now. So, and of course, again, by saying that, I'm not downplaying the practice. Actually, the opposite, I will say. The fact that I had no clue about that speaks about something that has been uniquely crafted in a particular group. Now, that said, of course, something that is uniquely crafted from a very creative place and whatever can end up being something mechanical, no? Not because it was originally intended as such, but it can happen with everything, as we already know. As I mentioned, radical personalism, that our purpose is to engage in Krishna consciousness, but if we do something mechanically, that creates Krishna unconsciousness. Instead of becoming Krishna conscious, we are becoming unconscious, because we are just entering into a catatonic repetition of things, losing sight of why we are doing that. And it can happen with anything and everything. And again, that goes back to wonder, not to what we were talking in 1 minute ago about wonder. Chamatkar. Chamatkar, meaning. No, I think it's interesting to connect wonder with purpose and meaning. How if you remain in wonder, you remain drawing purpose and meaning from reality. But wonder, and therefore purpose and meaning, won't come from the comfort zone, generally, won't come from the familiar and the predictable. So we need to step out of what is absolutely known to dare to live, basically, and to be confronted with wonder. So all this is connected, because if not, all of these practices just become like a validation of the statu quo, no? Like a confirmation of, okay, now at this precise moment, we have to say this, and we have to say that, and this is being done like this, and this. And maybe all that is okay. I'm not saying you have to disrupt every Sunday, the Sunday program or something like that, to remain in wonder. No, it's not like, okay, we will come on Sunday and we don't have a clue what will happen. No, so everyone is in wonder. Maybe it's too much. Everyone will be freaking out in neurosis or something. Give me some structure. Give me some order. And yeah, we need that. But I think a symptom of progress is that we want to be more and more intentional in our practices, no? The intentional aspect. What's the intention? What's the motivation? What the spirit of the offering? I am the offering. It's not what I'm doing. It's who I am while I'm doing what I'm doing. Who I am, who I am, who am I being while I'm doing what I'm doing? Because I'm the offering. So Rupa Goswami says, Niyama Graha, right? One of these six things that really damage our bhakti project is doing things without intention, basically, or without the right intention, or without the right understanding, or without the right motivation. And by saying the right, that doesn't mean there's one way of doing things right, one way of doing things wrong. I'm just saying, what's right for you now, right? What's the proper motivation at this stage of your journey in doing whatever? That's what I mean. No, it's not that there's only one right way of doing things, one wrong way of doing things. Let me learn what it is and that's it. I mean, no. No. So as long as it's an expression of, going back to the example you gave, as long as it's an expression of gratitude and it's a way of showing affection to a guest and chanting the names of Krishna from a place of blessing that person, and that person understands that and feels blessed, and it's a way of welcoming in a very warm way, I mean, that's great. As long as we do not lose sight of what's going on. And again, right? But if it becomes just like, okay, we have here the list of newcomers, here are the names, so now let's go to the Hare Krishna's tree per new name. No, it doesn't work like that. But you can do the exact same thing with full invested, with intention and motivation in doing it with presence. No, I'm present to that person. I'm honoring that guest. I'm treating that guest as if he or she will be Krishna himself. Atithi Devo Bhavan, that the scriptures say. An uninvited guest is like God himself. No? So I try to enter into that spirit, and I chant the names of Krishna to honor that soul and the potential of that soul. And all these type of considerations that maybe sometime we may need an introduction like that before requesting the three Hare Krishnas per guest. To put a little bit in context what we are doing now. And again, that extends to everything. That extends. Of course. Yeah, but what's kirtan? Why we are doing kirtan? What's the name? What we are supposed to do? To to relate to the name? What does it mean to chant the name? Sometimes we may need to speak about that before doing kirtan, in between kirtan, after kirtan. So all that is part of the kirtan. That's not separate endeavor, right? The notion of kirtan is very, I mean, I don't want to go there. That's a long journey. But like, for example, today we were, to give you an example, right? We were celebrating Srila Siddhar Maharaj's appearance, and we were there in Sri Chaitanya Saraswat Math before going to Hapaniya. And Srila Bhaktinandan Swami is speaking, and he tells me, okay, now you talk. And I'm like, oh, I was not planning to talk. I mean, everyone speaks Bengali here. I don't speak Bengali. He said, no, you talk something in English, and then we translate into Bengali. So before the whole thing started, someone asked about Puja Laraga Pata Gaurava Bhangi, which is a famous line composed by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati that Srila Siddhar Maharaj will highlight so much in connection to kirtan. Don't lose sight of what we are talking about here. Just an example of what's kirtan. And he will have this composition, this song he made when the deities were moved from the rented house to the famous Bagh Bazar Gaudiya Math in Kolkata. And this will be basically the main verse. Pujala raga pata gaurava bhangi matla hari yana bisaya range matla hari jana kirtana range. It's a long, we need a separate lecture for that verse to explain it. But basically what he's saying is, pujala raga pata gaurava bhangi, the path of raganuga bhakti, the path of divine greed, we worship that path with awe and reverence. No, it's not that we hope to worship Krishna with awe and reverence, but we worship the path of sweetness and intimacy with awe and reverence as something above our heads. And the way we engage in our main anga of sadhana, which is kirtan, in such a way as to offer proper reverence to this path and attain the path, the ultimate is matla hari jana bisaya range or kirtana range, which is interesting because he used this word interchangeably. Bishayarange kirtanarange. So he's saying we are engaging in kirtan, and what's the way to we engage in kirtan? Bishaya. Bishaya means sense enjoyment. So his idea basically is this: for us, kirtan comes from kirti, which means fame. So kirtan is a practice meant to glorify Krishna, and our way of glorifying Krishna is to engage absolutely everything in this world and use it for Krishna's service, to the point that we look like sense enjoyers. No? Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is riding on car as a sannyasi, constructing a marble temple, all the things that were absolutely shocking for the time. And it seems like you are totally materialistic. Like you say, no, 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 no. We are completely consuming all our faculties. No, we have so much greed in the wrong direction. So the way to heal that wound is by engaging all our senses and all our faculties in the context of kirtan, in the context of praising Bhagavan, investing money like crazy, throwing millions for a marble temple and stuff like that, which seems like bisaya, sense enjoyment. But he says that's kirtan. That's an intensive, passionate engagement of all our faculties to offer, to shed proper light on the glories of the path of raga, of the Brajavasis. By doing that properly, the greed from our heart will disappear and the sacred greed will come by Krishna's grace. Many more things to say, but all that just to give a nuanced explanation of what it means to do kirtan. No? So in the same way, with other practices, like, okay, let's say Hare Krishna three times to greet the guest or whatever, we may need to amplify what we are doing. What do we mean by that? What's the implications of that? What's a guest? What does it mean to be grateful, to say thank you, to say Hare Krishna? No? So, because we have a great tendency to be reductionistic and just limit ourselves to the performative level. What I'm supposed to say, what's next in the function? Okay, I'm a good girl. I'm following all the steps. And Krishna consciousness becomes just a set of formulas, of magical formulas, to learn and to be saved after that as a reward for how much of a good girl, good boy I am. And it has this that has nothing to do with what we are talking about here, becoming a passionate lover of God, so to say. So anyhow, some thoughts. I hope that helps in our quest and exploration.
Yeah, Maharaj, actually, just the last part of my question, I was asking that, to just expand that. I think even like, when we were at the retreat, how we were doing different like prayers before lunch, right? Like instead of doing the usual one. So it was kind of including all of that, like as, the standard common practices. So what I was asking you is that, do we like go back to doing all that at some point, or is it okay that we kind of continue and it changes? And j by us changing, does it mean we are deviating and like, creating our own thing or something like that?
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that part of your question. I wouldn't establish a formula. I wouldn't say like yes, every time necessarily if you're advancing, you have to, I don't know, recite your own prayer before prasham. You cannot just say the official one because that shows that you are still in the non-spontaneous level of praying. I'm not saying that. But also, I'm not saying that doing that is deviation, right? Each case is unique. To follow my point, it's not just one, because if not, we are making again one size fits all. No? The more you advance, you are supposed to do it this way. Even if that this way seems like very open and liberal, still you are limiting it to only that way to be possible. And that's not necessarily the case. So there may be devotees who are very advanced and may be reciting every single day the same prayer for prasad, to give an example, but it's never the same prayer. It's never coming from the same place. Some others may compose a spontaneous praise every single day, and maybe one resonates more with one and than the other. Again, you have to give yourself permission to be creative and to be sensitive to what works better for you. And I think there are certain logical parameters in which we can explore without becoming heretics, so to say, right? I mean, I can understand that in the beginning there is fear of that, and it's like I may be deviating, and some other people may be thinking of you as such just because you are not following the standard formula, basically. But again, we have to have, and I understand that in certain stages you need the standard formula and you need to be told how to do everything in only one way. Because if there is a second way, you become confused. Now, in the beginning, we are not good with diversity. No, Prabhupada gave the classic example. No, you have the small seed you put and the small first sprout, but you have to put a wall inside, not like a fence, because it's so fragile to winds, to other external influences. So you don't see anything outside the fence. That's your perimeter, that's your world. But you are growing meanwhile. The fence is not preventing your growth. So you are growing above the fence and you're rooting yourself, not rotting, rooting yourself. Down. So you are growing down and up. You are going higher and you are going deeper. And when the moment comes, you will see beyond the fence. And of course, the idea at that moment is not to build a higher fence. So you remain inside the fence. The person who put the fence has to know where the fence will reach. I mean, when it's healthy for the fence to reach and when it's healthy for the fence to stop growing, so to say. No, so in the same way, in one's practice, we have to have some proper accompaniment, proper mentorship, proper guidance, so we are supported and accompanied in our growing inside the fence and in our growing outside of the fence, thinking inside the box, thinking outside of the box, another way of putting it. So We may have some intuition, we may about it, we may need to confirm that, get some feedback. It has to happen in that organic way, through dialogue, through conversation. But again, there is no fixed formula. Some people will do the same thing in the same way forever, externally, but internally it's not the same. Some other people may need to change externally because they are not able to keep evolving internally with the same external form. So, and that doesn't mean they are more advanced than the other one. No? Again, each journey is unique. No? Let's keep it personal. Okay, we'll go with Divyangana now.
Haribol Maharaj. Yes, I had a question regarding, I think I heard you one time speaking about the inner guru, if I'm correct. And
inner what? Inner guru?
Inner guru, yes.
Uh-huh.
And so, yes, because my question is, it's a little bit two-part, but I'm very happy with my relationship with my Diksha guru, but I naturally... I don't know. It happened that I'm following different person, and I'm not only listening to his teaching, let's say, and so yes, and I wonder, because usually it's not really like the way it's teach. I feel like traditionally, I don't know. So yeah, it's a little bit. I was wondering what. Is it correct to act like this? And also, when you speak about the inner guru, or it's something inside you that guides you, how do we recognize the inner guru, differentiating it from my self-will, let's say?
Okay. The audio sometime came back and forth, so I'm not sure if I understood every single detail of the question. I hope so. You tell me. So it seems that there are more than one question. It's like the inner guru, how to recognize the inner guru, and also having a Diksha guru, but listening to other gurus or other people. Is there a place for that? How to deal with that, and so on. So something like that. Okay. So, of course, the inner guru is mentioned in the scripture. It's nothing, nobody but Krishna himself in everyone's heart. Let's put it that way. Let's be simple. Chaitya Guru, that's named Chaitya Guru. Many times we hear that name of Paramatma. That's an interesting point, because sometimes we also make the point that, okay, Paramatma is in everyone's heart, but it's kind of indifferent. Sometimes I've heard that. But if you call Paramatma Chaitya Guru, how can you say that the guru is indifferent? How those two things go together, right? You say God is in your heart, but in a passive, indifferent, impartial way, but he's your Chaitya Guru. So guru, now by nature, guru is someone partial to everyone. Let's put it that way. No? A guru is someone with a good heart toward those he is being a guru for, no? Compassion, mercy, unconditional love, acceptance, and so on. So that's an important point. So we have that guru is there in our hearts, and it's not passive in the sense of just not saying anything and just watching, but it's trying to create the most favorable situation internally through advice, through revelation, through inspiration. Of course, how good of a disciple we are in connection to our inner guru, that's another conversation. How attuned we are to the inner voice of revelation, that's why in big part it's emphasized the importance of an external guru. No, an external guru is someone who somehow, through his or her example and teachings, will help us to better discern the inner guru, right? So if we have proper connection with an external guru, let's put it that way, that will take us to be more and more attuned with the inner guru. And there shouldn't be like a, of course, there's no competition there, right? It's not that the external guru will say, you, of course, in the beginning, it may say, you just listen to me. Don't get too distracted. Again, putting a fence around the little sprout. But ultimately, the spirit of the external guru is, you will be so attuned with what is coming through the external guru that eventually the internal guru and the external guru are one, are non-different. Mm-hmm. And we need to reach that point because, let's be honest, I mean, we may have an external guru, but you don't have an external guru next to you on every single moment of your life. So you have to decide for yourself. For yourself, hopefully, align with the internal guru. But you cannot just send a message to your external guru and ask, what's your opinion about this? What's your opinion about that? What's your opinion? And that I will say, that's why also another way in which the Bhagavatam is put in that is when the Bhagavatam says, at times you have to be your own guru, which may sound even like a deviation for some. No? How you will say that you are your own guru? Well, for me, it has to do with this. It has to do with you have to be capable of taking enlightened decisions, of representing guru to yourself. And again, that has to do with connection with the inner guru by virtue of what you received from the outer guru. So that on one side. And of course, we have also Shastra. So there is this kind of, I don't want to say triangle, but there's this type of revelation that all of them should go aligned. No? What does holy text say? What the inner guru say? What the outer guru say? And on top of all that, so to say, you have your own personal experience. How do you feel about it? No? Pratyaksha. Because your personal experience ultimately gives the verdict. Mm-hmm. Because no matter how much someone may tell you, this is inner guru, this is outer guru, this is revealed message, if you personally feel bad, worse, whatever, you will say, I'm not going there. I'm not going. My experience is telling me something different. No. So that's why Sanatana Goswami will say that pratyaksha is the ultimate pramana, the ultimate evidence for the truth. No, we have to have an experience that is self-evident enough for us to want to continue pursuing that call, that direction, right? So whatever happens coming from a genuine guru, inner, outer, scripture, will create in us an unprecedented experience that we never had before. And that shows us in all our potential, in all that we can be. And naturally, that inspires us to go further. So in connection to having one Diksha Guru and listening from other people, of course, again, different people, different cases, different stages. But the advice that we receive is, for example, from Jiva Goswami, the Bhakti Sandarbha and other places, when you have one guru, somehow there is a commitment with that person. If that guru is, of course, you chose that person and that person chose you, it's a mutual choice. It's a type of marriage. Not for anyone to feel like forced to anything, but also to understand that we take choices in our lives and we have to be responsible for our choices. Not like, okay, I accept you as my guru and tomorrow I stop talking to you forever and I continue with my life like if nothing happened. No, there has been some commitment in between, some choices, some decisions, some responsibilities, and we grow by taking them seriously and by choosing to invest ourselves in that particular relationship. So I'm saying all this for what? Because Jiva Goswami will say, Okay, so you accept the Diksha Guru ideally from that place of trust, commitment, responsibility, affection. So it makes sense that you will try to align yourself with that particular person. And whomever else you are listening to, if that happens at all, should be people that somehow aligns and complements what you are listening from your main guru. I'll give you an extreme example. Not so extreme, but extreme in one level. Let's say you have a guru, and I personally have had some experience of that. No? You have some guru or gurus coming from some lineage. No? For example, our line that most of us is connected to coming from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, and his disciples, whether it is Srila Prabhupada, Srila Sridhar Maharaj, both of them, some other. Most of us, I don't want to sound sectarian by saying that, I'm just giving an example. So most of us are somehow linked with this DNA, Bhaktivinoda Parivar. So we may have gurus there, Diksha, Siksha. So what if somehow you start to listen from someone else that you liked, you are inspired, but you eventually discover that that person considers that the line of Bhaktivinoda Thakur is not bona fide? No. So will I continue to listen to that person or not? I'm not telling people what to do, but you follow my point, right? It starts to conflict. I mean, if I feel my main connection and shelter and nourishing from a line that for me is so real, and for someone else that same thing is not bona fide, something that won't take you to the ultimate goal, I may need at least to think for a while what to do, because probably that won't be aligned with what I'm receiving from my main gurus. So there is a type of loyalty also in that connection. I wouldn't say that's institutional. I wouldn't say that's formal, external. It's just like, it's a natural loyalty, a natural chastity to something or particular people or lineage that is nourishing me. And I feel that commitment and I feel that responsibility. You know? So I think, because sometimes what happens today is that very casually we just, especially with social media dynamics, we just listen from everyone. But the point is, traditionally, you are listening from someone and you are committing yourself in a relationship with the someone you're listening from. It's not just, oh, I like your class. That happens to me a lot, and that sounds so strange for me. People writing to me like, oh, Maharaj, you are my Siksha Guru. And I'm like, oh, really? How you decided that? Because I was not aware of that. I thought it was a mutual decision. It's a relationship. But for some people, it's just, no, I listen to your classes often, and that means you are my Siksha Guru. And I'm more like, well, for me, that doesn't mean that I'm your Siksha Guru. It just means that you listen to my classes often and you like them. But to be a Siksha Guru, or to be a guru of any type, for me, Diksha, Siksha doesn't make too much of a difference. That entails a relationship. That entails mutuality and reciprocity and commitment, mutual, and so many things. That's not a joke. So for me, sometimes it gets too casual, like, oh, you are my Siksha Guru, or I'm listening to this lecture, to that lecture. And it can become some type of, and I'm not saying it's your case, Vyangana, or I'm not pointing to anyone in particular. I'm just saying it can happen. So it can be like some type of potential intellectual shopping, so to say. Like, I'm listening a little bit here, a little bit there, and a little bit there, and I'm taking ideas. But is that increasing my commitment to the ideal that I'm pursuing? Or is more like an intellectual sense gratification? No, sorry if it sounds that I'm talking strongly, but it's possible that this happens also. So we shouldn't be just like light in this connection. Mm-hmm. So I'm not against people listening to more than one person. I'm not against finding guru everywhere. I talk about that many times. Ultimately, there is not a place the guru is not, and we can find guru in every atom. In principle, yes. In practice, probably not. In practice, we may need to commit in certain directions with some particular personalities, and from there grow in reciprocity and in commitment and in back and forth. And from that, we will hopefully reach that point where, yes, we can take siksha from the blade of grass, so to say. But yeah, I will make an important some emphasis on this point of listening. It's important to be committed to the direction we are listening from. So yeah, sometimes one may ask one's own guru about his her opinion about that, or one may just feel that particular alignment, and one can see it's not listening to this person is really. I mean, you can see the fruits. Now, if you have your Diksha Guru and you're listening from someone else, and that someone else is nourishing your faith in your Diksha Guru in a very healthy, nice way, and that's great. No? If everything is in place, now, if the Diksha Guru is properly situated, the Siksha Guru is properly situated, the disciple is properly situated, I mean, there is place for all that also. But also there is place for other things. So we shouldn't just think that by doing things without any discernment, everything will happen in the most auspicious possible way. Not necessarily. So yeah, some discernment should be always applied. I don't know if that helps, Divyangana, if I understood the question correctly.
Yes, thank you. It helps. Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So we have two more raised hands, so I think we will go with those two and conclude our meeting today. So first one is Anutam Chitra. Please, you can unmute yourself.
Pranam, Maharaj. Maharaj, I had this question from Nectar of Devotion, in one of the chapters called Offenses to be Avoided in Serving the Lord, one of the offenses mentioned is one should not cry or howl before the deity. So I was just wondering how sometimes in the process of being vulnerable, is it not natural to shed tears? And I'm also seeing tears as an expression of vulnerability that way, especially if someone is choosing to be vulnerable in front of a deity or holy names for that matter. So I was just wondering if the crying or howling here is referring to the act of shedding tears, then would that mean, is it forbidden to express oneself through tears?
I think that, if I'm not mistaken, someone asked that question some time ago, and I remember we were talking about it. Time ago, probably a year ago or more. And it makes sense, of course, if we just read that literally, it's like, okay, I'm not supposed to cry in the temple. Any type of tears, forbidden, whether it is being vulnerable, being ecstatic, being joyful. If you start to cry, please go to the restroom or to the restaurant, or we can have a crying room probably. So you don't engage in apparat. No? So you go there and you have your napkins and all that stuff required. But no, actually what the spirit of that particular instruction is more in the context of like, do not get accustomed to go to the deity merely to bring your lamentation, so to say. Now, of course, Krishna is saying artha jignyasura artha arti. So people who approach me are the afflicted ones, among others, the ones looking for wealth and knowledge. We know the verse. One of them are the afflicted ones. So Krishna is welcoming everyone. No? He's open. But the spirit of this section is like, okay, Krishna's welcoming everyone, but do not just limit your approach to Krishna to go only with your tears of lamentation, of affliction, and just Krishna, give me relief because this happened. And that's Krishna in your life. No, Krishna exists to give you relief, when he's a relief giving machine, something like that. No, so when you have the relief, you don't need to go to the temple, to the altar, until you are crying again in desperation from suffering the reaction of your previous actions. So you go to Krishna, give me relief, but I don't need to change. Just give me relief to the consequences of my actions. And Krishna suffering. So that's mostly the spirit of that verse. No, like don't use the deity, the temple, God, just as a napkin, so to say, right? No, don't beg for relief without the willingness to change what needs to be changed, so you stop doing the mistakes that create the consequence that you are looking relief in relation to. No, because many times that happens. No, many times that happens with Krishna, with some devotees. People come to you to reveal their mind and they just want to do catharsis. And when they are relieved and you are about to start to tell some advice that may help them not to make the same mistake, you go, no, I'm okay. Thank you. I feel better now. Goodbye. And I'm like, okay, see you in 15 minutes. We're in 2 days because you haven't changed anything. So you will do the same mistake again and you will come again with the same need for relief and it never ends. So that's the spirit. No, don't get accustomed to see God, the Vaishnav, just as a repository of your tears and look them for relief and just not being willing to change. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the idea in that connection. No? That, like, ultimately for a devotee, the idea is not to approach Bhagavan from that place. No? There's place to start from that place and from any place, but this list of offenses is more connected to someone who is more committed in the practice, so to say. Now, if you read those offenses, you will see that many of those things do not apply to the newcomer, do not apply to the one who is just casually showing up to the temple and doing things that a newcomer won't know that those are not ideal. So they do not apply to them. All that is for those who are supposed to be in a more serious, progressive relationship with Bhagavan. So that will be basically the explanation. And as you can see, it extends beyond just mere tears in the temple room, but do not be like utilitarian in your connection with Bhagavan. No. I mean, the relationship can begin in that way, but shouldn't become standardized as such. Basically that. Okay.
Yes. So, yeah, what I'm understanding is it has its own place, but then that shouldn't become the only mode of contact with the deity or with the Lord. There can be moments where someone does become vulnerable, like even if they're not in the beginning stage or even if they have been practicing the process, sometimes there could be upheavals in life and it can just shake them to the core. So even if someone is committed in the process, Maharaj, I'm wondering if there can be moments, you know, where they simultaneously account for, you know, their own choices, but then sometimes the force of life, they can still...
I will say that's valid. I mean, I'm not canceling those situations. I'm just, as I mentioned, I'm mentioning the spirit of this is do not get accustomed to just see Bhagavan in terms of that. To just see in terms of that. That doesn't mean that there are moments that you really need to cry your heart out to Bhagavan. And that's not offensive, again. If it comes from a very genuine, sincere place, but if it comes from a place, again, of I'm not willing to change, I'm just being stubborn and doing the same mistake over and over again. And every time the consequences come, and running to Bhagavan and crying for that. That's the main thing that is not recommended here, basically. But that what you are mentioning, I will say it's its own category. And it could be more an exception to the rule. No, hopefully it's not the rule that one is going through that on a daily basis. But if one is going through that on a certain period on a daily basis, of course there is place to go from from a place of looking for shelter and mercy and grace. Because you may be go and crying to Bhagavan, but that doesn't mean that you're asking Bhagavan just stop what's happening. Maybe you're just crying, expressing your pain, your suffering, and I'm praying for purpose and meaning and for being able to continue to navigate whenever you need to navigate and learn from that. So again, it has a lot to do with the sincerity and the disposition to continue to grow and to learn. Yeah. That's important thing. And the denial of that, the unwillingness to change, to learn, that's aparad. Remember, aparad means that which goes against love. Aparada. No? That which goes in the opposite direction of love. What's the direction of love? It's ever evolving, always growing, always changing, always expanding. What goes against love? No change, no willingness to change, no openness, not growth, but remaining in the same situation and trying to use God for that to happen. That's aparad, technically speaking.
Yeah, so it's more like an excuse to continue staying in one's own comfort zone. Sure. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, and that's ultimately the... I mean, in some tradition, there have been saying that, no, that the sin is the refusal to growth, no? Not more than the hot sins, as sometimes you will hear in some traditions. Because sometimes we overemphasize that. We overemphasize always lust and greed and anger, envy, but the refusal to growth, that's heavy. That's complicated. That's subtle. No, the denial to progress and sometimes we in some parts of our tradition we have become very expert at scandal and being scandalized at, oh, I saw that devotee smoking cigarette and that devotee was a monk and was with a lady, and we kind of like make it such a huge thing. But if we are in denial of growth, we are duplicitous, we are so many things that are invisible and have nothing to do with the gross physical situation, we may normalize that. That's not like a big problem. And that's arguably a bigger problem than the other stuff. But somehow, if I caught you smoking marijuana, that's a bigger event than if you are being in denial of growth and just evasive and addicted to certainty and just remaining in the status quo forever and using Krishna for that. For me, that's worse. But many times we don't even identify that as an anartha. We don't even see that as a problem because it's invisible, because it's not just I caught you smoking on the corner or whatever. So we need to recalibrate how we approach all the things, right? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let's go to Martina. She has last raised hand. And then we'll conclude with the breakout rooms. Yes, welcome, Martina.
Thank you. So I have a question basically further to discussion you had with Sveta Dipradika. Actually, when she posed the question came to my mind about prasadam prayer, and she even mentioned that at some point. But so, I mean, I stopped reciting prasadam prayer, the one that we know, because I just can't relate to it. I mean, in a sense, I have a need to, like, first properly honor my body, you know, to see my body as a gift from Krishna, and to just properly honor it before understanding what is everything wrong with my body, right? But I'm just wondering, I mean, my question is not should I recite it or not, because I kind of decided not to do it and I do my own prayer. But I don't know, maybe at some point I will completely understand this prayer and I would want to recite it. So I wanted to ask you for the first line, which is kind of not clear to me. It has like a very strong wording, actually. When it says, I mean, Mahaprasada Govinda, I'll just read the translation that says, for those who have amassed, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, very few pious activities, their faith in Mahaprasad, in Sri Govinda, in the holy name, and in the Vaishnavas is never born. So if you could just say a few words about this first line and how is it connected with the rest of the prayer, because it's really not clear to me.
How is connected with the rest of the prayer? What do you mean by the rest of the prayer? That same mantra? Because,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rest is more saying this material body is place of ignorance, da, 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 you know, and then the first part is saying that a person who doesn't have enough of pious activities actually cannot have faith, right? Faith is never born in Sri Krishna, in holy name, and in Vaishnavas. So I would just like to understand, what does it mean? I mean, in what sense pious activities, and then connection with the rest of the prayer? Because for me, it's kind of not connected. I don't know. And it's like very strong wording.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll say something because we don't have that much time
yeah,
now.
Yeah, of course.
But something we can say. So this Mahaprasad Govinda verse, Nama Brahmani Vaishnavisvalpam Punyam Bhatavrajam Viswasanaiva Jayate. This is a verse from Mahabharata. Appears in Mahabharata. I think it appears also in Skanda Purana. So as you are mentioning, it mentions something like, okay, people who is not very elevated in pious activities, punya, svalpa punya vatam rajam, cannot believe or do not have faith in Mahaprasadam in the Mahaprasada of Govinda, or in Mahaprasad, nor in Govinda, nor in the name, nor in the Vaishnavas, Nama Brahmani Vaishnave. So I can see that, of course, it's in one sense, it's not a verse that necessarily is a continuation of the next one or something, but it makes just the point. Someone has the microphone on, if you can just turn it off, please. So basically speaks about, when we are speaking about here, punya, or credit, or piety, generally, we will understand that more in terms of bhakti sukriti, not so much about like material piety, because you can be very materially pious and not necessarily have faith. No, vishvas. The word here is vishvas. Svalpa punya vatam rajam vishvasanai bhajat. Vishvas is another way of referring to having shraddha or faith in all the things. So implying basically that, one way to understand this verse is, it makes sense that if you don't have faith in the things, if you have not acquired bhakti sukriti, you are not expected to have faith in these things. No? So there is no need to condemn people or to criticize them if they don't have faith in Mahaprasada, Govinda, Nam. That's a way of reading the verse, no? Which is makes sense to me, which invites to be open-minded. No, it's not so much a superiority elite model, superiority complex thing like, okay, we are the ones who have faith in Mahaprasad and Govinda, and we are not like those who do not have faith, that therefore we are so glorious. It's not from that spirit. No. So you can take it always in a way that is humbling and open. So in this case, it will be okay, it makes sense that in order to have faith for these substances, you need to have acquired some bhakti sukriti, some previous impressions by sadhu sangha and so on and so forth, that naturally make you appreciate what's Mahaprasad, who is Govinda, what's the name, right? Like implying that's the way you should appreciate that, by proper experiences, proper impressions, proper piety, proper sukriti, and not otherwise, no? Like don't force yourself to have faith in something that you don't understand why, so to say. So that verse could be understood from that place, which is very broad-minded and deep. And the next verse, I will say. So that's in that sense, that verse is setting like a proper stage of broad-mindedness. And in another sense, we could say the next verse, Sarira Vidyajal, of course, this is a long, this whole song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And I can understand why some devotees do not feel that call to recite it either. But also there is a place to, because also sometimes the translations are a little bit like doing a disservice to the whole thing. You know, I never heard that translation because we wouldn't say that in that way. But I heard that something, how did it say it in English? This material body is...
material body is a place of ignorance, and the senses are a network of paths leading to death. Somehow we have fallen into this ocean of material sense enjoyment, and of all the senses, the tongue is most voracious and uncontrollable. It is very difficult to conquer the tongue in this world.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to this world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So first I will say, okay, I understand the tone, the translation, but not to just blame the translators. I mean, it's in, on some level it's there in the original. And again, we have to travel in time. Okay, how things are expressed in certain time, in certain culture. Is that the only thing that someone like Bhaktivinoda Thakur say because he composed his prayer? So we have to put all in the scale, right? We shouldn't isolate one prayer and, okay, this is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is about. I don't like him. No, it's not like that. When he's saying Sarira Abidyajal, this body of ignorance, again, we can interpret this like, okay, this body of ignorance. What's this body of ignorance? No, it refers to an ignorant way of relating to your body. It doesn't mean that necessarily the body is bad. It's just speaking about a particular way in which we relate to our bodies, which is in ignorance, because it's possible to do that. We know, let's be honest. No? And in that particular situation, the senses are problematic in that situation. In another situation, the senses are facilitators. We have talked about that many times. The senses can be an obstacle. The senses can be facilitators of bhakti. That's what Rupa Goswami says. Atasri Krishna Namadi Nabhavet Grahyam Indriyas Bon Mukhehi Jivada Swayam Eva Spuratida. Through the senses, you cannot contact Krishna. When you engage your senses in seva, Krishna manifests through the senses. So he says the two things. So I will read this whole section of this prayer in that term, in that sense, in that line. Yeah, there is a way of saying, when we say, okay, this material world is miserable. Okay, yes. What do we mean by that? Material world, the planet Earth, the material energy, or a particular way of relating to all that that creates misery. It's ultimately that. It's ultimately the state of consciousness through which I am relating to all that. That's the miserable thing. It's not. It has nothing to do with the energy in itself, which we have talked many times. It's how we are approaching all this. So this body of ignorance, it's the prayer is assuming that particular perspective, and then creates the contrast, as we know, no, an enlightened perspective of honoring prasad through the senses, through the body. So it's not against senses or bodies. It's just creating a contrasting scenario of living a life, an enlightened life, seeing the body as the all-in-all in a self-centered way, selfishly. And in that way, the senses are the door to death and all that stuff, which is true in that particular context. So again, I think we need to recontextualize some of these prayers. And of course, by this, I'm not saying recontextualize them, continue to recite them. There's no other way, no other way, no other way. There is place for spontaneous expression and prayers, but also there is place to revisit all these sections and rediscover them and reread them in a way that is more relatable. Now, without changing the essence of that, just reading them with more breadth and depth. So those are some few thoughts. Again, I already extended myself a little bit, but my battery is running off, to be honest. So I think I will stop here. We can continue later. I'll conclude and we will leave space for the breakout rooms for those who would like to join. Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai, Abhirbhav Mahotsav Tithi Srila Bhakti Rakshakshar Dev Goswami Maharaj Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, all Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru.